Support for this podcast is made possible in part by our members. Become a member of WNTI by visiting our ePledge page at WNTI.org.
You're listening to Contours, WNTI's Issues and Arts program. Now your host, Melanie Teal.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Contours. Today on the show, we'll be hearing from a jazz trio called Time for Three, Bill Nutt's interview with Elaine Boozler, who will be appearing at the Newton Theater on August 23rd, and first up, Dr. Carl Recco tries to explain virtual reality. Thanks for joining us today. Enjoy the show.
You may be familiar with the holodeck on board the Starship Enterprise, or maybe you've been immersed in the virtual reality of the movie Matrix. Well, the actual development of virtual reality environments is now here to stay. The development of immersive 3D environments give researchers a chance to travel through their data and visualize a protein structure, a hurricane size, or a depression circuit in the brain. 3D virtual reality worlds can help us make sense of this in a tangible way. Using computing power to translate data into something that can be seen and heard makes it easier to understand. Our guest, Linda Marsa, will help us move through this world of virtual reality. Linda is a contributing editor for Discover Magazine and has been practicing investigative journalism in the areas of science, medicine, the environment, and personality profiles. She's also written newspaper columns for the Los Angeles Times and has been on the faculty of UCLA. Welcome to our program, Contours, Linda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This was
a very interesting story to write.
Oh, really?
It was really interesting. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask something that you're probably ready to answer right now anyway, but the question is, what exactly is a 3D immersive environment?
Well, I that's what I thought, too. You know, I thought, well, what is this, and why is this so great, and, you know, why is this that it really can help research? Because it's very hard to, pardon the pun, visualize it.
Yeah.
And so basically, you know, to sort of step back, you know, a couple steps, is that when you look at a lot of the great scientific discoveries, you know, we always talk about, you know, we get our best ideas in the shower, or we get our best ideas when we're, you know, sort of in that netherworld of half awake, half asleep, things like that. And, you know, so it's the whole idea of being able to sort of visualize things and, you know, sort of get your arms around it.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the background of all of this. And then the other piece, and just cut me off because I tend to go on and on.
No, by all means. No,
you're my guest. Okay.
You're my guest.
I'm not boring anybody. But, you know, the other piece of this is that, you know, now we're in this era of big data, which is really wonderful in some ways. You know, we have, you know, tetrabytes and petabytes, you know, which are quadrillions of, you know, bits of data. But what are we going to do with all this data?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's really hard to sort of, you know, sort through all this data. And so what some researchers have done, and it's not just researchers, but it's, you know, government researchers, universities, but also private industry, too. You know, places like GM are using this technology to sort of visualize, you know, safety programs, you know, rather than, you know, doing the models, you know, those crash tests. They can now do this in a virtual way to see, you know, what happens. So basically, you know, to sort of step back, you know, you have all these data bits. And what is happening is that these data bits can be converted into pictures that are easier for researchers to comprehend and digest. And everything that you see on these reality decks is a number that has been crunched. And how it sort of works, you know, as best as I can sort of explain it, is that you have these mathematical algorithms that are translated into mostly visual frequencies, but also sometimes auditory frequencies, by mapping their vibratory spectrum in a light and sound domain. And it's sort of like mapping heat, you know, through infrared light.
Okay.
And And what they do is they use a specialized software and computational language to translate mathematical algorithms and scientific data into sight and sound. So that's sort of as succinctly as I can explain it. And then, you know, each of these environments is a little different and does something a little different.
Okay, suppose I have, say, for example, some kind of data I've collected that deals with the environment on Mars, you know, many images or something of that nature, some information, some data. How could that be translated into a 3D virtual reality environment?
Well, to sort of step back, you know, what is the problem then with why not just look at it in your computer? What do we need all these, you know, big hotshot kinds of places for? You know, but the problem is when you're looking at it in your computer, you're only getting a small slice.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's part of the problem. You know, one of the things that I talked about in the story was this expedition to Antarctica, you know, where they were at Lake Bonney, which is sort of the same thing. You know, Antarctica is sort of like going to Mars, you know, it's sort of this very desolate landscape.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing. And so what they did is they took the pictures, and if you're looking at each individual picture, you know, and looking at each of these slices, you really can't get a sense of what's going on. And the difference is to look at the panorama. So you take all the pictures that you have, and rather than spending a year, you know, because this is what, you know, the researcher told me it would take is a year to go through all this very carefully and look at it.
Yeah.
You can crunch it, you know, put it in one of these immersive environments so that you're actually, in a way, there on the, you know, on the on Mars. And seeing, you know, all the pictures that, say, the Mars rover took, and you can look at it in a panoramic way so you can see it. It's almost like, not like being there, but, you know, you sort of get a much deeper sense rather than looking at each individual slice and how things relate to each other.
Now, could you interact with that immersive environment to any great extent?
That's a good question. Some of these environments allow you to do that. Others don't. It just depends upon, you know, the sensitivity. The reality deck at Stony Brook, at State University of New York at Stony Brook, probably has some of the more advanced technology. And they have this thing that's called, you know, where you can just sort of, you don't need to pan or zoom. You can just walk up to the place that you're looking at, and you can start interacting with it, which is really quite remarkable.
How would you interact with it?
It's called Infinite Canvas. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
How would you interact with it? A touch screen or some kind of device that you'd use, like a remote device, or what might it be?
It depends. That's a good question. It depends. You know, some of them have touch screens. Other of them have joysticks so that you can sort of navigate. You know, the Allosphere, which is at UC Santa Barbara, you know, will take you on a fantastic voyage through the cells or through the Milky Way or something like that. And you use a joystick. It's very similar to what you would have with video games, you know, sort of traveling through that.
Hmm. Now, is it possible for someone to set up a system like that so they can interact with an environment someplace else on Earth or on the moon or Mars, in a sense?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that they're using this for, is one of the really, I found, utterly fascinating applications of this was a project at UC San Diego, the Star Cave. They've been using this archaeologically, and what happens is that you know, they're sort of digging at these remote sites in Jordan and places like that, and these expeditions to Mongolia to look for the long-lost tomb of Genghis Khan. And, you know, you have researchers on site, you know, in Mongolia or in Jordan, beaming back these images, and then the researchers at UC San Diego can work with them back and forth while they're talking to them, and sometimes they're even able to use infrared technology to tell them, you know, there's something under the ground here that maybe they're not able to see with their instruments that are actually there. So it's really incredible what they can do with some of this.
Now, how many places do have this kind of a system set up where they can project this 3D immersive environments?
It depends, you know, on what you're talking about. Some of the most advanced environments, you know, like the one at Stony Brook or the one at UC Santa Barbara or UC San Diego are, you know, sort of state of the art. But I found in doing research, and I have to tell you, the biggest problem I had doing this story was whittling down, you know, five of the most advanced technologies, because what I found is that a lot of places are using this type of technology, maybe not to the extent of, say, Stony Brook, which has, screens of 1.5 billion pixels. And just in comparison, high-def TVs have 2 million pixels, while 3D movies have 4 million pixels. So the reality deck is very advanced. But these are being used all over the country at government agencies. I found that, you know, a lot of the NASA agencies are using these to do climate modeling and weather. A lot of universities around the country are using these. Not quite as ambitious as the ones that I highlighted here, but still, you know, that idea where you're taking all this data, you're translating it to something visual, and then being able to look at it on a massive screen.
Oh, okay. Our guest is Linda Marsa, and she is contributing editor for Discover Magazine. And also she's an investigative journalist, and that involves areas of science and medicine and the environment and so forth. And she's also written newspaper columns for the Los Angeles Times. Now, Linda, in terms of your experience in this whole thing, how many of these areas have you been to that you could experience this kind of immersive?
Well, I went to a couple of them. I did the Allosphere, and then I saw the one down in San Diego. I'm down out in Los Angeles, you know. But you can see them just on your computer screen and see what they look like.
Yeah.
The one that really, the thing about the Allosphere, you know, each one is slightly different, you know, and does slightly different things. And the thing about the Allosphere one, which is at UC Santa Barbara, is that it's sort of this gigantic cube, you know, that's like, you know, about 40 feet high and, you know, 30 feet wide or whatever. And it's sort of this 2,000 square foot room that's three stories high. And you're sort of surrounded, you know. I mean, talk about immersive environment. You know, you're really surrounded. And I have to tell you that, you know, you're standing on this bridge and you're kind of looking. And we did this, you know, sort of tour of, you know, the bloodstream. And, you know, we're kind of going in and out and, you know, kind of avoiding the liver and, you know, kind of circumventing, you know, the heart. But I have to tell you that when I was inside this, the Allosphere, I really felt like I was in kind of a roller coaster ride. You get that sort of disorienting kind of effect, you know, and I, you know, we didn't include it in the story, but you feel like you're sort of in free fall.
Oh, wow.
You know,
wow.
Because of this immersion, because it is sight and sound. So it's all your senses that are, you know, involving you. Now the one down, you know, the Star Cave down in San Diego is, doesn't have the auditory, and it's not like, you know, where you're sort of enmeshed, you know, sort of surrounded in there. It's more, you know, the screens are projected around you. It's a little bit different. You're not in this, soundproof kind of cave. So it's a little bit different experience.
Oh, okay. I just came from San Diego, too. I could have looked into that if I knew about
it. Yes. But you never know.
Next time.
Yes. Yeah.
How long has this been in practice?
Well, the first ones were developed at the University of Illinois, and this was in this really sort of backtrack. It was developed probably, you know, it was Tom DeFonte, who's a senior scientist. He's now at UC San Diego, but he was at University of Illinois. And, you know, these guys were sort of old hippies, you know, computer geeky guys in the 70s that were really sort of, you know, and it evolved, you know, from the very earliest, you know, virtual reality things that came out in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I think that the very, very first one of these immersive environments that had the technology was probably in 1990, 1991. So we're looking at 20 years that they've been around.
Oh, okay, okay. Now, what got you interested? What piqued your interest so that you would get involved in writing something about this area?
Well, it was assigned to me.
Okay.
I'm there, you know, I'm one of their West Coast people, and I'm in Los Angeles.
They had
discovered the Allosphere. So I went up there to look at the Allosphere, and I was extremely impressed. And I just thought it was really a fascinating thing. And the other piece of it is that as a science writer, you know, I talk to scientists a lot about big data. And, you know, we're in this incredible revolution, which, you know, the layperson doesn't realize it, and I really barely realize it, too. But, you know, there's incredible computing power now that we can bring to bear on scientific research. Just to sort of pull back for 1 minute, you know, I just did a story on Alzheimer's, and they're really discovering many more Alzheimer's genes because they can take the genome of 50,000 people, put it in a computer, sift through it, and come up with anomalous genes in people who develop Alzheimer's. I mean, this is incredible.
Really?
And they can do this in a week. You know, I mean, this was something that would take, several lifetimes, researchers, 10 years ago. But what do you do with all this data? You know, and this seemed to be a way of really sort of putting your arms around it. And I thought that was very interesting. The other thing that, you know, we haven't talked about that much is, and this is more the reality deck, which I'll talk about in a minute, is that this can also be used for surveillance, which I found really fascinating. The reality deck, because it has all these pixels, 1.5 billion pixels, can take pictures that has the most incredibly high resolution. They took a picture of Barack Obama's 2008 inauguration on the mall, you know, and there was 500,000 people there. And the resolution is so accurate that when you interact with this infinite canvas that I talked about earlier, you can actually see the face of every single person
what
they're wearing.
Well, it's like Google zooming in on your property.
Right, that's right. That's right.
Now, is the public allowed into any of these places to see what's going on and get an idea of what this whole area is about?
Oh, sure. Yeah, at all the universities. Oh, sure. You know, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be called. But, you know, these 3D immersive environments, a lot of these electronic visualization labs, they have them all over the country. And, sure, a lot of the big universities have them now.
Now, do they converse?
I was amazed to find that out.
Do they converse with each other in terms of what they're doing and maybe have some kind of cooperative effort going on between themselves?
Oh, sure. Like I said, it started out at the University of Illinois, the Electronic Visualization Lab, and that research team, they still have a research team there, but they all moved to UC San Diego, and then, you know, obviously the technology that they're developing, they all share with each other, absolutely, and, you know, trying to make it better.
Yeah. Now, any of these scientists speak to you about future developments in this area, what they intend to do, how it can be used as tools in other areas as well?
Well, like I said, thwarting terrorists, you know, is one of the things, weather predictions, climate modeling. Getting back to the reality deck, which he called, the inventor, Ari Kaufman, who was a very colorful guy, calls virtual reality on steroids, which it really is. But Hollywood has come to calling. They're looking at this, you know, technology for the next generation of high-def TV and 3D movie experiences, because it really, you do have this sense that you're there, you're involved in this, and it creates this incredible feeling of immersion. So I think that that's where, you know, the technology is moving more and more towards higher resolution, you know, being able to capture even greater images and more and more involving. And, you know, like you talked about the interaction, I think the interaction at this point is somewhat rudimentary, although I hate to use the word rudimentary because this is such sophisticated technology. But that whole infinite canvas idea, you know, being able to go up. And the other thing is that as you walk around in these immersive realities, it sort of follows you. You know, that has this kind of tracking so that they know. Because you're wearing, you know, people wear goggles when they're in there, you know, 3D goggles.
Yeah.
Although very sophisticated, not like the stuff you get at the movie theater. And so I think that there's going to be more and more of the, you know, just making this technology even better than what it is.
So you wrote the article then about this whole area in the Discover magazine. Is that July, August?
Yes.
Oh, okay. What's the article?
I think it's in the September issue.
Oh, September. What's the article called?
I think it's called Big Data.
Big Data.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. I'll make sure that I look at that. I've seen part of it already on the internet, but I didn't read the whole article yet. And do you intend to continue on maybe your investigations in this area?
Well, I really definitely want to track it because I think it's really fascinating technology. And I think it's really the future, you know, of where we're going, and not of all science, but in a really wonderful adjunct to scientific research that can be really incredibly useful and really accelerate and expedite the pace of scientific discovery.
Oh, okay, Linda, thank you for being on our program. Our guest has been Linda Marsa. She's an investigative journalist, and she is a contributing editor for Discover magazine and has just submitted an article that deals with a 3D immersive virtual reality environment. Wow, that's going to be something that's going to be quite interesting in the future. Well, thank you very much, Linda.
All right, thank you so much.
WNTI and Kennedy Event Services are bringing live music to Knowlton as we present WNTI Stage August 15th, 16th, and 17th at the Knowlton Lions Club Pavilion on Route 46 in Delaware, New Jersey. A weekend of food, fun, and two stages of nonstop music under the big tent. Beer and wine concessions sponsored by the Knowlton Lions Club and free Wi-Fi by CenturyLink. The fest begins on Friday night with WNTI favorite, the Grand Slambovians, with opening act Billy Hector at the Cafe Stage. Other acts for the weekend include Marshall Crenshaw, the Devil Nellies, John Ginty and Todd Wolf, as well as many local favorites. So please join us for 3 days of summer fun, August 15th, 16th, and 17th at the Knowlton Lions Club Pavilion on Route 46 in Delaware, New Jersey. No pets and no coolers, please. Free parking. Schedules, tickets, and information available online at WNTIstage.org.
It's worth noting that not that long ago, the idea of a female stand-up comic was considered a foreign concept. The fact that it is not a foreign concept now in 2014 is to the credit of a number of people, not the least of whom is Elaine Boozler. It is worth noting that Elaine Boozler was the first woman to host a solo stand-up comedy show on cable. She's still out there doing her thing, and she's going to be doing that thing at the Newton Theater on Saturday, August 23rd. It is a pleasure for me to say, Elaine Boozler, welcome to the WNTI airwaves.
Oh, thank you so much, but I don't have much time. I'm already putting on makeup.
You don't need that much for now. You know, am I overstating it? Was it? Did you encounter a lot of resistance as a female stand-up in the 70s when you were?
Well, not from the people, not from the audience. Just, you know, the old men in business, the old powers that be, and you see it everywhere. It's in government, it's in show business, it's in the corporate world. It's just the way it's always been. But from the day I stepped on stage in 1973. You know, the audience was delighted, which let me know that I was doing the right thing. And then about 12 years later, when all the guys were getting, you know, their early stand-up specials, HBO and stuff, and I kept trying and trying. And I was doing a two-hour concert in those days, which I'm now doing again. So bring a pillow to the show. I kept going up and asking. They said, oh, no one wants to see a woman do an hour. And I said, I do 2 hours, and I follow half the guys in around the country that you've given shows to. And they always say, hey, we're going to make our money back this week. So nobody would give me a show, and it was driving me insane because you couldn't go to the next level. You were just playing the same clubs for the same money. So luckily I met someone who would a true filmmaker who said, we can do this, you know, with the little teeny bit of money you have in the bank. And of course, I didn't have credit cards. And we did it. And most people worked on, you know, the back end, meaning, of course, you'll sell it. It's you. You can pay us then. And so we got to make this great show, which turned out to be Party of One. And they turned it down for the next year. And I said it was like, this is a very old reference, but it was like the Duddy Kravitz bar mitzvah film. That was a great movie in the 70s with Richard Dreyfuss. And he was a very auteur kind of filmmaker, and they hired him to do their son's bar mitzvah. And he turned it into this National Geographic horrific.
Right.
So basically, I felt like I had the world's most expensive home movie on my shelf. And the great saying in television is, if someone doesn't like you, wait 5 minutes. And that's what happened. A year later, all the heads of Showtime comedy and HBO comedy got replaced with younger, hipper guys as the world turns. And I brought the film up there, and they went, this is unbelievable. And it was. So that's what happened. Goodbye.
Now, you mentioned to me off mic that you're thinking about writing a book about the second golden age of comedy.
It's written. Okay. Yeah. It just needs to be pared down to, you know, something that people could carry.
Well, what was it? I mean, I don't mean to say what was in the water, but what was it about that particular time that served as such a fertile ground for so many comics whose work is still having an impact today?
Well, I think it was a great confluence of things. It was right after, you know, the Love Generation of the 60s, and music had changed totally, and society had opened up, and Nixon had shown that, you know, not everyone in power should be listened to, and Lenny Bruce had happened, which was incredible, and changed comedy forever, because, before that, you would watch the Ed Sullivan Show or The Tonight Show, and it was pretty much the same kind of hangdog married men and women complaining about their husbands or wives, and it wasn't any social commentary for the most part, except probably for Mort Saul, and it wasn't, you know, question authority or anything very personal. They bought jokes from writers, but then you had Mort Saul, Lenny Bruce, Lord Buckley, who you should look into if you're interested in comedy, folks, and it just became all of a sudden, you know, the town crier thing of, wow, there's personal experience here. And it became a younger person's venue, which it had never been. It was always middle-aged guys and a few women. And suddenly I went to become a waitress in New York, my ultimate goal. And I walked into a room of Richard Lewis, Andy Kaufman, Freddie Prinze, Jimmy Walker, Gabe Kaplan, Ed Bluestone, Richard Belzer, and a couple of, you know, well, Jay Leno that year, then later David Letterman, and Larry David was there, and I listened to these guys and laughed my head off and thought, gosh, I think just like that. They go, you ever think? And I go, yeah, I think. And it was a whole new thing. It was like jazz in those days. It was this hot new thing that, you know, a few hip people had discovered. There was no money in it. Everybody had a day job. Mm-hmm. But it was this kind of new craft.
Now, let's fast forward to 2014. I'm sorry. What's different about the craft now? Is there anything different about the craft?
Well, I guess, you know, the thing that, I mean, how many bad haircuts have you gotten? How many bad dentists have you seen? How many bad realtors have you left? The truth is that there's 10 good of everything in every profession. So, you know, you get 10 good hairdressers and 10 good doctors, and the rest is people who either didn't get an A in school or just, you know, fell into it for the money or the quick whatever. So the difference is there's still 10 great comics or 20 great comics and a lot more bad ones, because just like the news cycle is 24/7 and there's a lot of, you know, junk that really isn't news that is thrown at you all day and night, it's the same with comedy. There's a lot of bad junk out there that, you know, makes me sad for stand-up. And it's, you know, it just muddies it up. The thing that's dangerous about it is people who don't know good stand-up, because they're newer or didn't have the older days to learn about it, they think this is stand-up now, and so they rightly say, I'm not spending a dollar to go out and see something like that. And so it does hurt those of us who still call ourselves writers first and really know how to deliver a good, you know, hour and a half to 2-hour full show that comes full circle in Evening of Comedy, a show. So I always hope that people will, you know, give us a chance to show them what we do, because we consider it an art. And there are still lots of people like me who make it an art.
We're talking with Elaine Boozler. Now, how has the landscape changed for you? Are you writing about different things now? Then obviously, you know, with the passage of time, you're at a different place than where you were chronologically, if nothing else.
Oh, sure.
What is what you're doing now different than what you were doing, say, 20 years ago? And how is it the same?
Well, clearly, if you write every day and you're a thinker, then it's fresh every night. I mean, if you came and saw me 10 nights in a row, you would see 10 different shows. I wish I had a set show, because it would help a lot on nights when I'm not thinking well. But I just, it's a very live thing. And the thing that's still exciting about it for me is that it's really the last live thing left. Even at ballpark, singers lip sync the anthem, and presidential debates are certainly scripted. So, you know, plays are great, but they're scripted. The last live thing is you coming out there on stage and just starting to talk. And, you know, and whoever's there that night saw this piece of art get painted in front of them. And then as they walked out of the theater, it just kind of disintegrated like skywriting. So you really had to be there. So to me, that's the most exciting thing. And I remember as a kid watching comics on the Ed Sullivan Show, and 10 years later they came out with the same 10 jokes. Mm. And I thought, oh, that's comedy. But, you know, it for me and most of my peers, it's not. It's literally what's happening today. So my act is like every part of the newspaper, which will be gone soon. You know, it's news and sports and lifestyle and trends and health and everything. It's just, if you leave, you know that you saw the show on August 23rd, 2014, because that will be the show. Unless I'm there on the 24th. When am I there?
Yeah, it's the 23rd. It is the 23rd.
Oh, yay.
Very good. You talk about the fact that you consider yourself a writer first. There is another set of muscles that you develop, and that is acting. And I just wondered if what you have most enjoyed about acting. Is there any acting that you're particularly proud of? And is there anything in the works that you can talk about?
Well, I have no acting stuff coming up. But I really did like all the different parts on, you know, there would be guest starring roles on different sitcoms for many, many years. And, you know, it's always good to get off the road when you were tired of traveling and then act and then realize, my God, I'm stuck in a trailer all week with nothing to do, and then get right back on the road and be happy about it. So that was good. I think the favorite part was playing the blind woman on Night Court. She was just scheduled for one part, but then they kept bringing her back. It turned out to be a lot of fun. So that was great. And the thing I liked the most about acting was just a chance to work with other people, because stand-up is so solitary. Mm. So it was always a lot of fun to, you know, be on the team for a while and then go back out alone.
We're talking with Elaine Boozler. What was the best bit of advice that you ever got as a stand-up?
I think it was, don't listen to anyone. You know, and it's the one I pass along, whether I came up with it or got it, I don't remember. But no one knows what you in your heart of hearts know what you're aiming for. Nobody knows what you're capable of, including you, until you put in the time. So to have someone come and decide what you are or should or can't be and listen to that will just, you know, ruin it. You have to just say thank you, goodbye, you know, and go back about what you think you're doing and just slowly discover everything for yourself.
And that is the advice that you pass on. Do you find that there are other comics out there, male or female, who treat you as a mentor or think of you as an inspiration? Has anyone gotten back to you?
No idea. I have no idea. You know, no idea. I did forget one good piece of advice. Years ago, when I was growing up, there were game shows hosted by a very funny comedian named Jan Murray.
Oh, yes.
And I watched him when I was a little kid. So when I finally met him at an event, you know, it was very exciting because it was someone I had seen on TV my whole life. And, you know, I hadn't been on TV yet, so it was just unbelievable to me. And so I said, well, I'm a comedian starting out, and what's your best bit of advice? And this is what he said to me.
Uh-oh.
Don't ever go in a swimming pool with nobody else around.
Those are words to live by.
I have to say, it's helped me through comedy in all these years.
Does it surprise you that you're still doing stand-up after, I've got to say it, 41 years?
I guess it surprises me that I'm alive after 41 years. Everything surprises me every day, you know? Absolutely.
Is retirement a word in your vocabulary? Do you ever see yourself getting to a point where, you know, I'm not sure I should go out on the road anymore, or you know, I'm tired of this?
Well, I don't get tired of it, but if any rich man would like to marry me, I would certainly consider taking a few years off to travel the world with you on your yacht.
Do you have a favorite place to play?
You know, this is so funny. Any place the audience is good is my favorite place. You can be in Hawaii, in heaven, in paradise, in the most gorgeous surround that people save up their whole lives to pay for and go to, and you can be there for free. And if the audience is bad, you are in hell. Mm-hmm. And you can be on the side of the road in Macomb, Michigan, in a snowstorm, keeping your cheese in the snow so it doesn't go bad, and think, oh, what is my life? And you go on stage, and it's a great audience, and you're so happy to be there, you can't believe it. So it's really dependent on that.
That's interesting. That's interesting. The Police talk about the show that very early in their career, when they went to a bar in upstate New York and they were booked, and there were like three people in the audience, and they still say that was one of the best shows they ever did.
It's because true.
Everybody
it's
loved
true.
It.
Yeah. And if you're in a gorgeous place like Hawaii and you have a bad show, it's like it makes it worse because now you can't even enjoy that you're in this place. So you just want a good audience. It doesn't, you know, any place is good. I remember a great show in Ocala, Florida that I did in a barn on hay because the guy had the magic number and we came. And I'll always remember that show.
Wow.
I'm standing on hay bales like my heels are falling through the cracks. I can't even see the audience. They're smoking so much. I could barely breathe, and it was still one of the best nights of my life. I never had a better time.
That's great. That's great. We've been talking with Elaine Boozler, and to remind you, Elaine is going to be doing her stand-up routine at the Newton Theater. You're going to like this venue, I think, at the risk of building
I'm
up
sure.
expectations.
I am sure. And we'll be looking for popcorn under the seat.
It is a converted movie theater. It's a nice size.
I'll be there with the tickets. Maybe we'll just have the tickets ripped in half by someone in a tuxedo as people enter.
For more information, you can go to thenewtontheater.com, and that's theater, R-E, Elaine. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much
for the time. And thank you for giving us a lot of reason to laugh.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In these times, I think we all agree we need to laugh.
Well, I agree too.
For Contours and for WNTI, this has been Bill Nutt.
WNTI and Kennedy Event Services are bringing live music to Knowlton as we present WNTI Stage August 15th, 16th, and 17th at the Knowlton Lions Club Pavilion on Route 46 in Delaware, New Jersey. A weekend of food, fun, and two stages of nonstop music under the big tent. Beer and wine concessions sponsored by the Knowlton Lions Club and free Wi-Fi by CenturyLink. The fest begins on Friday night with WNTI favorite The Grand Slambovians, with opening act Billy Hector at the Cafe Stage. Other acts for the weekend include Marshall Crenshaw, The Devil Nellies, John Ginty and Todd Wolf, as well as many local favorites. So please join us for 3 days of summer fun August 15th, 16th, and 17th at the Knowlton Lions Club Pavilion on Route 46 in Delaware, New Jersey. No pets and no coolers, please. Free parking. Schedules, tickets, and information available online at WNTIstage.org.
Hello, boys. How you doing?
All right.
Great. How are you doing?
Nice.
Greetings from New Jersey.
All right.
New Jersey. Where about in New Jersey?
Warren County, right by the Delaware Water Gap.
Cool. I am a Jersey guy. This is Renan speaking. I actually grew up in South Jersey, and I live there currently.
Oh, where do you live? My brother lives in Cape May.
Oh, excellent. I live in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
My niece lives in Audubon.
Love it.
Yep. Got a lot of connections to all over New Jersey.
Nice.
Awesome. Yeah, we're playing the World Cafe on Wednesday in Philadelphia.
Oh, great. Yeah, we're a station exactly like at WXPN down at World Cafe.
Sweet.
Oh, nice. Very cool. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, are we recording? When should I start?
Yes, we are rolling.
Thumbs up.
Okay, then I'll do a quick introduction and we'll take it from there. And my interviews are fun.
I can tell already.
I don't want any stuffy answers or anything. Give me the fun stuff.
Yeah. Nice. You just prompt us and we'll go.
My All shirt's right, off.
On the phone with me today on WNTI, I have not one, not two, but three gentlemen on the phone with me. Zach DePew, Nick Kendall, and Rian Meyer. And they are part of a group that just put out a new CD, and from my good friend Max Horowitz at Crossover Media, was sent to me, and it is called Time for Three. So welcome to WNTI, and would anybody like to start off to be the spokesperson and tell me about how Time for Three got together? You guys sound like a fun bunch.
Well, Renan, Nick, and myself have been a group for 14 years, and it's been a lot of fun for us.
Would it be okay? We're recording, right?
Yes.
Could we start over? My name is pronounced Renan Meyer, if that's okay.
Did I say it wrong? I'm sorry.
Oh,
Renan.
No, it's fine. Would that be okay?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Let me start over again. In the studios of WNTI and on the phone with me today, I have not one, not two, but three lovely gentlemen on the phone with me. Zach DePew, Nick Kendall, and Renan Meyer, and they are from Time for Three, a group that's been together for quite a few years now. They have a new CD out called, what's the name of the CD?
It's
Time for Three.
Yes, it's a self-titled album.
Their new CD is a self-titled item. Their new CD is self-titled, Time for Three, and I'm going to let the three of them speak for themselves about how they got together and what they're up to. I know they're going to be at World Cafe in a few weeks. So welcome to WNTI.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We're actually going to be at World Cafe Live this Wednesday, I believe.
Perfect.
Yeah. We're very excited coming back to our stomping grounds where we met, went to school, and all of us lived for quite a spell, actually, a big part of our lives and upbringing are based in and around the Philadelphia area and certainly Center City.
So how did the three of you get together? It's been 14 years, correct?
Yes, we're getting old. at Curtis, we basically would jam after our long orchestral rehearsals, and the faculty and administration caught wind of us, and we had an opportunity to play for an event. We put together 25 minutes of music and just had a total blast doing it because we thought it was going to be actually our first and last gig. And we're just all college buddies, you know, that wanted to go hang out in D.C., which is where the gig was. So that's pretty much why we accepted it. And then when we got down there, we played for this big event and they loved it and they wanted encores and we didn't have any because we only put together 25 minutes. So after it was done and because of this positive reaction from the audience, we decided let's at least try this one more time. And we did, and we had a very similar reaction, and that's when Time for Three was born.
That's a great story. So college buddies and you're still together all these years.
It's crazy, but it's definitely the case. I mean, definitely one of the advantages of being together for so long is that we know each other so well. And, you know, when we're creating together, or most importantly, when we're on stage, I think that's one of the advantages. We just, so much of what Time for Three is in a live performance is the act of spontaneity and really riffing off of each other's energy at any one moment. A lot of people, it's been interesting on this summer tour when representing the album, a lot of people say, how much of that is improvised? Because it seems like all of it is improvised. Where in fact, a lot of our creations are written out, but the way we play with each other and the way we spin our collective sound as individuals towards our collective group sound is one that relies on spontaneity and really interacting with each other through our instruments and our energy. And so it comes off as being completely made up on the spot. But it's really satisfying and probably one of the greatest experiences that a human being can have when you're so locked in with two other individuals, in this case, two other individuals that you know so well and been playing for so long with.
Now, Zach, I want to ask a question for you specifically. You're the violinist.
I am one of the violinists. Nick is also the other fiddle player.
Okay, and Nick too. So now, there's been quite a resurgence of fiddle playing, violin playing in mainstream music, you know, AAA, adult album alternative type music.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be a good feeling for you. You know, that all the jam bands, all the bluegrass, newgrass bands, they all have a fiddle player or a violinist in them.
Well, the violin is an awesome instrument.
Yes, it is.
I mean, we both love it. It's a versatile instrument. And I think, you know, what you're seeing now is it coming out of its shell, so to speak, the classical shell. And, you know, when you think about the guitar pre-1950, classical guitar, but you think about when they plugged in and electric guitar and swing and all that, I mean, it really, you know, the violin is sort of going through, a very similar experience right now. And a lot of violinists are reinventing how to approach it, how to make sounds out of it, and it's an exciting time for violins in general.
Now, the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, you had a 3-year residency there. Time for Three had their res. Were you happy when that ended? I mean, was that daunting, or was it a really good experience?
Oh, actually, you know, we're still in residence there. We just finished our 5th year, and we're about to go into our 6th year, I guess that kind of answers your question, because it's really just been enthusiastic and wonderful. It's been an amazing partnership. They gave us this series to run called the Happy Hour series, which we took over 5 years ago. It was kind of a dying series. They only had about 150 to 200 people showing up to it. And the idea was to get young professionals into the symphony orchestra and to have that experience. And it just wasn't working. So we took it over and immediately kind of transformed it. Our first program was, something like, why can't, or who said Coldplay and Beethoven can't mix? And immediately we kind of quadrupled the ticket sales of the series. And now we've built it to the point where it's sold out, for everyone that we do. And it's creating this revolving door. So these young professionals come to the orchestra, they experience Happy Hour, and then they want to go and see other things that the orchestra is doing. And it sort of demystifies it for a lot of people.
Yeah, and, you know, Coldplay and Beethoven, they can both rock out.
Absolutely. No doubt. I think one of the things that we have enjoyed about this series is also helping to maybe saying change the minds of the musicians on stage and the administration of orchestras, but help them understand that there is a creative and authentic way to create an experience what we do that is authentic within itself. We built, you know, Happy Hour was created as a pointer to, so we basically get audiences into the hall and then say, well, really, you're here because we want to show you that this other stuff is happening. But I think what we've all discovered together is that the kind of experience that Time for Three has created is actually wonderful, wholesome, and great in itself. And that orchestras are realizing that they can authentically create experiences that are like this. And it's not it's just one of the great offerings that they're able to do in their own communities. And that's a very exciting thing, that we're able to show how that can actually be tailored and crafted together.
Oh, yes. We're speaking today to the members of Time for Three and the WNTI Studios on Contours. And there's something in your bio that's very near and dear to my heart as well, and that's being committed to reaching younger audiences and music education. I'm a big advocate for you need music and the arts in public schools in order for children to succeed in life. Tell me about what you do as far as reaching a younger audience.
So with younger audiences, we have actually done over 1,000 educational outreaches in our existence, and it is not only a mission, it's a need. We depend on doing this because we value so much in this world creating people that want to follow their dreams and follow their passion, to find their passion in life and really go for it. We realize when we're playing for a lot of musicians that not necessarily they'll have the ability perhaps to all be professional musicians, because of course that's really challenging. But to inspire the ones that want to do that and you know, to encourage them to follow those careers or their careers. But then the people that
just want to do music as a hobby, to also have that enable them to find their greater passion for whatever that may be. So that's something that we've been doing throughout the world since we started, but primarily here in North America.
Sounds wonderful. Now, so Time for Three, the new CD, I'm going to play a track from it, Happy Day. And
sweet.
We seem to be talking about that while we were on the phone here just now. And what else is coming up for you? What you're coming to Philadelphia this week. What's next?
Well, gosh, I mean, right now we just completed a live concert video shoot for in Indianapolis with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. WFYI filmed our happy hour series with the symphony, which is where a lot of these collaborations and a lot of these musical ideas started and stemmed from. We're very excited about it. It's in the can, so to speak, and it's being worked on right now and developed. So what's coming up is really, you know, hopefully a PBS special coming out of that concert. Again, in hindsight, we were able to play with Joshua Bell at the Hollywood Bowl with the Los Angeles Philharmonic just a couple weeks ago. We did a tune written by Edgar Meyer called Death by Triple Fiddle, and that was a lot of fun. Yeah. Upcoming stuff, we're very excited about, you know, obviously the date in Philadelphia. We're going to be in Alexandria, Virginia. We are starting a relationship out in Sun Valley, Idaho. We're very excited about a wonderful music festival there. Yoshi's in California, the Cabrillo Music Festival in Santa Cruz, getting to work with Marin Alsop again with Jennifer Higdon's concerto written for us, Brit Music Festival in Oregon. We end up this season, right up to the beginning of next season. We end up at Royal Albert Hall playing with the BBC, Symphony Orchestra at the Proms, playing Chris Brubeck's concerto that he wrote for us.
Wonderful.
So we're incredibly excited about that. It's a busy summer. But we're very pumped about everything that's going on.
And let the listeners know your website and some contact information in case they'd like to purchase your CD online or just get in touch with you somehow.
Absolutely. Well, so it's timeforthree.com, all spelled out, TimeForThree.com. We have our featured video up there right now called Banjo Love, which is a song that Renan wrote for us. We shot it in New York City. It's a lot of fun. We also have other videos featured there. But, of course, right there you can go straight to iTunes or Amazon to purchase our latest album. We suggest Amazon because then you can actually get the hard copy and it's fun to have the actual booklet. And please follow us on Twitter, also Instagram. And we love sharing our stories from the road, which we do more times than one a day. So check us out there.
Hey, I also wanted to tell you that I actually had the pleasure when I was 19 years old of playing in a jazz trio that played at the Deerhead Inn, which is not too far from you guys there. And
don't know how I love the Deerhead
Inn. Nice.
It still exists, right? I mean,
it's thriving. The jazz community in Delaware Water Gap is alive and well, and my husband and I adore going to the Deerhead.
Well, I was so excited. I remember when I got offered that date with the pianist that I was playing with at the time, and I just was so, so stoked. So really fond memories.
It hasn't changed any. I'll tell you that. It looks exactly the same as it has for the past 30 years. So
super cool.
It is. It really is. Oh, well, thank you. Zach and Nick and Renan, Time for Three here on 91.9 WNTI.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Thanks.
That's it for this week's edition of Contours, your weekly roundup of what's happening in the WNTI listening area and the surrounding communities. Thank you to everyone who made today's show possible. Contours is a production of WNTI and can be heard Sundays at 9 a.m. with a rebroadcast on the website, WNTI.org. If you have a topic you'd like to hear discussed on a future edition of Contours or a comment on today's show, just send me an email, teelm@centenarycollege.edu. That's T-H-I-E-L-M @centenarycollege.edu. And we hope to see many of you, if not all of you, out at WNTI stage next weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Knowlton Lions Club Pavilion in Delaware, New Jersey on Route 46. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, everyone.